Welcome to yet another episode of Shortcast Over Coffee. Today, my guest is Karthik Kumar. Karthik is an actor, director, writer, stand-up comedian, and an entrepreneur, and the well-known founder of Evam. He has acted in popular movies like Alai Payudhe, Yaaradi Nee Mohini, Poi Solla Porom, and recently Rocketry. Karthik will be touring in the last leg of his tour with his fourth comedy special, Aunsplaining, which will cover multiple cities across the US, culminating in London between February and March. Check out the show notes for more. In this episode, I will talk to Karthik about his life as an actor, entrepreneur, and everything about his venture, Evam. So let's get into the episode. Hello, Karthik. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Bala. A pleasure to be here.
It's actually, we are recording this on Christmas Day, so thank you for that, taking out time.
Merry
on
Christmas,
Christmas
to everybody.
Yeah,
at any point of time you're listening to it, may the Christmas spirit always be with you.
Yeah. I mean, most likely it's going to release today, so yeah, this is pretty timely.
Yeah, Christmas spirit is too good to be used only at Christmas. It should be valuable for year round.
Yeah, that is so true. Karthik, I want to get into your childhood growing up years, but we want to get the elephant out of the room. I read that you were auditioned for Madhavan's role in Alai Payudhe, and it quite did not work out because they said that you were too young, you did not have any background in acting, etc. So tell me more about that. How did that happen?
I was too young was the answer for it. Background in acting is the reason I got into that audition in the first place, because at that point of time, I had completed about 4 years of amateur theater. So I was doing the rounds of doing amateur theater in Chennai. I was also a frequent actor in short films at that point of time and ad films at that point of time. So I think I got the audition call from Madras Talkies, and I went to audition for I don't know what, but eventually it ended up being for the lead. And I was deemed too young for that part. And that's true. I was barely 18 or 19 at the point of time. And yeah, that was my first stint with a tryst with the film.
Yeah,
world.
So you had not approached anybody till then. It was just like you had no thought of getting into films at that point.
No, I was, as I told you, I had done 4 years of theater already through my engineering as such. So I was looking to the dream of getting into the entertainment world and the arts world was already seeded at that point of time. So it was not like I was accidentally found myself in front of a camera. I was training to be in the performing arts for 4 years as an amateur. And that kind of seeded the dream eventually, which became a reality where saying, I want to make my living doing arts and performance. And I will find a way to make a living doing just that. I don't want it to ever become a hobby, or I don't want to wait for somebody to give me an opportunity and find me. I want to find myself constantly.
Yeah, that's an excellent thought. Do you remember how that day was? What were you asked to do?
I went to meet Mani sir straight. So there was actually no camera. There was absolutely nothing. I just got a call. I was having a bath at home, and my dad picked up the call, and he said, "Call from Madras Talkies, it seems. Do you want to talk?" I came running from the bath, and I took the call, and then they scheduled me an appointment. So I went and met Mani sir. It was extremely intimidating, but I think at that young age, I wasn't so. I was a lot more brash, young and naive. So I was very happy to meet him rather than feeling scared to meet Mani sir. But yeah, that was my first experience, and he immediately thought I was too young for it, and he was right. And I think a couple of months later, I got a call from the assistant directing team, and I got a call from and they said, "Hey, there's a part that sir would like you to consider. It's a very small part. Would you like to do it?" And my answer was, "I would do pretty much anything on a Mani sir set." So I found myself playing that part which kind of became iconic thanks to the film. So yeah, that began my journey in cinema, which continues to this day.
Excellent. You know, everybody knows that you are also an engineer. You did engineering from Sri Venkateswara College in Chennai. Was that something that you always wanted to do? Because, you know, I hear from you that you started your stage / acting career when you were, I think, 14 now, right? Because 4 years of acting experience before.
No, 4 years through engineering. So 4 years through engineering. Oh, okay. So, yeah. So by the time I auditioned, I auditioned for Alai Payade a year before my final year. I acted in Alai Payade on the set on my final year exams. So my entire journey in the arts and theater and entertainment was thanks to engineering, because engineering gave me enough time in the evenings where I was like, oh my God, I surely don't want to make a living being an engineer. I need to do something else. And therefore, I got into theater and entertainment. So that's engineering was my driver to decide this is not what I want to do in life. So,
awesome.
Yeah. So, yeah, I never wanted to be an engineer. Engineering was, I think if you are looking unsure and confused in life, they will send you to engineering school in South India. So
yeah, I think I used to have the same thought, and it's partly right as well, but when I think about it, I don't think there is any other field that gives you the best return on investment. Like medicine, you have to study forever to reach a particular stage, but like for a general student who is like average in studies, they can still make a decent living from engineering. I think that's where the thought stems from. Like probably the 50th percentile will still be able to make a decent living and a decent life from engineering. It's different when you push people like artists or sportsmen, sportswomen into engineering. But otherwise, if someone doesn't know what to do, again, I'm not pushing or I'm not encouraging the fact.
You're right. I think you're pretty much right. I think that's like, if you think of education as a return on investment, which is the worst way of thinking of education. it is. Because it's like saying, to buy a future and education, I think, should teach one how to handle life. I think all of our ways of looking at education is how will I make money back from this, right? So it's the most scary way of thinking of education. But yeah, I guess if that's the way you're looking at it, yes, it's a good mileage giving car.
Yeah. And sometimes people also have this fear of failure, right? I mean, what if I try something? We'll get into that in your aspect as well. But like the fear of failure is something that pushes people to just do a 9-to-5 job for the rest of their lives and get their living out of it and, come to a decent standard of living. So that's.
Yeah. Yeah. So failure as therefore deemed by society, right?
Yeah.
Like, or your own understanding of social gaze and social judgment, right? That the uncle next to your house and auntie next to your house or the potential ponnu paakara mamanar and mamiyar will deem you as not socially worthy. Yeah, in that sense, yes, it's a great way to earn a social badge of honor given by societal constructs that have no value by itself. But yeah, fear of failure. Yeah, failure is when you don't end up doing something that you probably were slightly curious about. That's the greatest failure in life.
No, that is so true. And I was talking about this with, I forget who, but I think I've talked about this with multiple people. There are some things that people want to do. Like when you're 17, you're 18, you want to become a cricketer, let's say, or you want to become a musician. You may love the end goal of being a musician and everything that comes with it, but are you okay going through the process? The process might not be as entertaining or as lovely as the end result. So there are a lot of people who aspire to be something and they quite don't like the process and they are not willing to dog it out and they quit. So that also happens. For instance, as a comedian, you may like you may love the presence of being on a stage, you may love the standing ovations at the end of it, but are you willing to spend time on scripts? That's where I was getting into.
I think when you are excited by the rewards of it, or the perceived rewards of it, or the rewards as they appear to be, right? There are very few coveted positions in society. Like nobody, I haven't seen anybody who has said that, oh, I want to retire at the age of 59 with a very, very modest saving, right? That doesn't look attractive. But everybody goes for that attractive. I think everybody goes for that. So that must seem extremely attractive to people, right?
Yeah.
Like a whole set of middle class families have the earning breadwinner of the family, unfortunately, up to the previous generation, usually male, who retired at 59 with a very, very modest saving. Now, that doesn't seem attractive, as I put it to you. But I think my peer group, about 95% of people are in that race to be that. So I don't know if people are motivated only by the end goal, because this seemed like an extremely... the motivation there is the fear of, what if I go for the sun and fall? Right? What if I fly towards the sun and my wings melt? What if I imagined I had wings in the first place? The truth of that flight is that you have to build your own wings. You have to discover and construct your own wings. They'll be extremely makeshift. Nobody's going to give you any guarantee. But you will eventually fly towards the sun. You'll end up landing in the moon. That's the logic. So you'll end up landing somewhere, but your initial flight was towards the sun. And you get excited by the investment that you put in the journey. You discovered your own wings, you made makeshift ones, you broke some wings, you fractured yourself in the process, you learned to reset after the fracture, you got attached to the entire process, and then you learned more about yourself. And that's the most meaningful journey in the process, because you did it all by yourself. And therefore, at the end of the day, you become extremely memorable for yourself. And that's essentially what we all strive for in life, to look back one day and say, ha, this life was a memorable one. I'm looking for the next lifetime now. If you believe in rebirth.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I think satisfaction with what you do is extremely important. And that brings me to the question. You said that you wanted to be an actor, and you realized at an early age that theater and acting was where you wanted to be. And then this huge blockbuster movie happens, Alle Payude. I think people still talk about it to this day. Fantastic launching pad, even though it was a minor role and not the lead character. After that, were you like, hey, I want to become a Tamil movie cinema hero? Because, I mean, from what I understand, you don't have any movie background. Nobody to push you, nobody to encourage you from inside your family. So, was that ever a driving force that I want to become a lead male hero at some point?
No. I think the job of a lead actor in Tamil cinema is very, very is partially art and partially politics, or rather partially art and most of it is politics. Politics is the journey of becoming popular with audiences, right? And therefore, eventually, so there was a reference point, like somebody as huge as Superstar, right? Superstar, I always never coveted or felt envious of Superstar, because I always felt like he was a slave to his fans, right? Because he had to tick the box of all his fans in every movie. And therefore, to see a Kamal Haasan on the other side, enjoy the artistic journey, but not be rewarded for it, right? Significantly in his own time. Right, 15 years later, you realize Kamal was ahead of his time or something like that. You know, it's, you don't see him enjoying success in his time per se. So I think I did not like both these references as much as I was envious, or not envious, probably in awe of Kamal Haasan's talent maybe. I wished a journey for myself in the arts which was sustainable. So I think my most exciting reference points, even at that young age, was to do negative lead roles and character roles, like the likes at that point of time of Prakash Raj and Raghuvaran. I was very excited by the roles they were doing. And I wish that for myself. But again, I was too young, right? Today, at the age of 45, 46 right now, I'm getting those kind of roles. Acting is a journey by itself. I mean, where you have seasons, you know, you have, there will be an ideal time to harvest, but you are not in control of that time. So,
that is so true.
Yeah.
Because, at least in Malayalam cinema, even in Hindi cinema, there are actors who were at their peak in, let's say, the mid-90s. And then for some reason, I mean, we just don't know why, but they won't get any roles. But they are at it, they are still continuing their passion. They are not quitting it and going off to do something else. And then there is suddenly a rebirth. Like, I think the greatest example is Bobby Deol. I think recently he is much sought after as the, the Jagapati Babu of Bollywood or something. Like, he's doing great as the villain. So that kind of makes sense. But it is so lucrative, right? Movie industry, there is nothing that pays you like the movie industry. And I don't think OTT platforms were not prominent at that time. So there must have been some drive to go all out on, or all in rather, on the movie industry. Just go on auditioning.
I didn't go all in the movie industry at all. I did not go at all. I didn't trust the movie industry as a viable source of a living at all. Because I don't think the way you describe the film industry is the truth of it. There are 90 out of 100 actors out there, 97% of actors do not draw a salary at all. Or if they do, it's completely sporadic and it's unpredictable. Right? So there are long periods of time where an actor is absolutely out of work and waiting and waiting and waiting. And if they have to see the film industry as a lucrative, regular job, they need to be willing to take roles that are in no way pleasing them artistically. Right. So in that sense, I knew that the an artistic journey which would depend on the film industry would be an extremely unsafe one, financially and emotionally speaking. Because I didn't have any relatives in the film industry. And I didn't have anybody to even share notes with saying, ipadi pannalama, yara meet pannalama. So everybody in the film industry have become contacts of mine after I worked with them. Never before, right? So in that sense, there was no sense of somebody guiding you or somebody being mentor or a guide saying, ipadi pannu, do this, focus on this. So I very quickly went into entrepreneurship in the arts world so that I could enjoy putting art out there that I would be responsible for making a living out of myself. So therefore, I think theater became a very, very important drama and theater, and live performance became a very, very important feeder for both my ambitions and my emotions.
Fantastic. So now let's get into Evam. What does Evam mean? I think it's a Sanskrit meaning from what I can think of. But walk me through the process. What made you start Evam in the first place, and what does it do?
Evam, I think, was a very young, ambitious mode to gain some control over your own artistic journey. You knew that you were about to embark on an artistic journey, but the biggest problem for artists in the Indian world of things, scheme of things, is that there is no nirandaramana varmana, right? So there is no safe way in which you are able to make money. And therefore, people always do the arts as a side hobby, or people see arts as people, artists as people who are not interested in money making, right? So it's, I wanted some control over that process. So therefore, I wanted to create an enterprise that in some way becomes a way in which I can produce my own art. I can create, and therefore there will be a producer for my own art, and therefore I can put it out there. And that's one of the reasons why I always held Madras Talkies as a very, very important example for myself in my life, because up to 1999, if you realize, until I think Mani Sir started India Talkies with Shekhar Kapoor and Ram Gopal Varma, right? Dilse was probably the first film that they produced under their own umbrella. So they owned the IP of Dilse, right? Uyire in Tamil. So by the time they came to Alaipayude, Madras Talkies owned the IP of every Mani Sir film. Today, when you create a film even as big as Ponniyin Selvan, Laika may produce it, as in they finance it, but the actual creative production and the entire thing is done by Madras Talkies. And therefore, Mani Sir has the creative and the artistic control over a certain project up to a certain financial degree. Right. And therefore, that's an important space that an artist needs to create for oneself to be able to, it, at some level, financially also have some control over your artistic product out there.
Mm.
Right. Otherwise, you will end up having external people coming and dictating what your art should be and how it should be and who it should pander to. I think you should be able to control even who gets a say and who doesn't get a say.
Mm.
Right. So therefore, as much as I'm talking about Madras Talkies, which is a point of a reference, we were doing the same thing in the world of theater and drama, right? So eventually when we became producers, even in stand-up comedy, we were able to put artistic output out there that we could create, produce, and deliver it to the market. So Evam was essentially a vehicle of entrepreneurship for our own artistic output. In my case, Sunil and Karthik. Sunil is my co-director at Evam. So both of our artistic output, Evam was the vehicle of entrepreneurship to carry those artistic outputs forward.
And Evam is that Sanskrit meaning, like and?
Evam is, it is a Sanskrit word apparently. But it for us, our first experience of that word was this Bengali play called Evam Indrajit. Evam Indrajit. All right. It's a Bengali play written by a very, very prominent Bengali playwright called Badal Sarkar. And the play was translated in English by Girish Karnad. And that's the first play we ever did as students in postgraduate institute together. So Sunil and I directed a play called Evam Indrajit. And the play was largely about, what do you young people in India want to make of yourself? Do you want to become Amal, Vimal, Kamal, Nirmal? Or do you want to be Indrajit? Do you want to be one of many people running the same race? Or do you want to stand apart and be a bolt of lightning in the sky that everybody will witness and say, oh, wow, right? So Indrajit was who Amal, Vimal, Kamal, and Nirmal are not. Indrajit is that other person, is that person probably walking the path that not many people have walked, right? So that kind of was our wake-up call to say, hey, I think we should not be running the rat race like everybody else. Just because I did my engineering and my marketing post-graduation, I should not become an engineer or a marketer if that's not my calling inside for myself, right? So I think we got into the artistic journey 2 years after we post-graduated, just because this wake-up call inside us was on. And we believe that play that we did set that fire inside us, you know, and that fire kept us burning for the last 20 years. So yeah, we credited to that play, and therefore we drew our name from that play. We took one part of that name and we called ourselves Evam. So,
you know, I was thinking how this name came about, and I was thinking in my head, you know, all the possibilities, and I would have never imagined that this is this is how the name came. Wow, Evam Indrajit. Okay, I have to look.
It was extremely personal to us. So we knew that nobody knew that word. They were like, what is Evam? What is Evam? Because we started the company in Chennai, and Evam is not a word that people were. So it became a new word for them. But we knew that it had extremely important personal meaning for us. Because whenever somebody says that word, we know the meaning behind it. We know that we should never, ever run a a race that everybody is running. We should run something different. We should do something that that we feel attracted towards, even though there is, seems to be no viability to it. Viability is something that the market will decide over time. You don't be a slave to the viability journey. Every journey can be made viable. It just requires a little bit of patience, persistence, and I think intelligence. Intelligence or intelligence. You should be able to smartly figure your way out. You, anything you do, you can make a living out of. You just have to figure a way to do it.
Hustle. Fantastic thought. And it reminds me of VVS Lakshman. So someone asked him, you are not a superstar like Sachin Tendulkar or Rahul Dravid or even Sourav Ganguly at that point. And Lakshman said that, I may not be a superstar, but when I get into the dressing room, people like Sachin, Dravid, Ganguly respect me. And that is more important to me than what my public persona is or how I am seen in the audience or fans. Not equating you to VVS Lakshman, but where I'm getting at is that I spoke to a few other Tamil stand-up comedians. One of them, Jagan Krishnan. There is GK, who is based out of the Bay Area. And they all spoke about you with such high regard. And that's where kind of where the analogy I'm bringing about. And they were like, Avam, it was my platform. Avam is where I started. They gave me an opportunity to do a stand-up, open mic. Jagan said the same thing. So, I'm sure you know this already, but like so many comedians have come out of Avam and they still think about you. They still think about how Avam gave them a platform. So congrats on that. I think it's a big achievement because, doing stand-up comedy is one and grooming stand-up comedians and helping them come out and realize their full potential is I think, something amazing.
I think they all, I'm not being modest here, but I understand the value of the opportunity they gave us to give them an opportunity. That's very, very critical, right? So they all looked to us saying, hey, can you help us make a living out of this? And we I think we're very lucky to have a lot of such brilliant talent come through us, right? Not because of us, come through us, all right? So we were probably the coaching academy that they chose. So we're lucky to have been chosen, eh? And I think that's essentially, to go back to the VVS Lakshman analogy. I'll give you an interesting fact. Like even today, the film industry people I interact with, right, are greatly respectful of the fact that I have another identity. I have another arts identity that's not film driven. Right, so it's a lot of respect that I get from the film industry people because otherwise they'll be like, "Enna sir, shooting vaanga sir, vera vela illana sir ungalku." They know that enakku vera vela irukku, and vera vela is not a software job or a corporate job. It's another artistic space, right? So I think that is the value of having multiple avatars in the artistic world. Otherwise, the entertainment world will easily disrespect your time or trample your autonomy as such. So,
That brings me to a very interesting question. Is that starting an artistic journey is one, and then realizing your full potential is another, and then the third thing is starting something on your own, like an entrepreneurial journey, like you did. And then the fourth part is making money, because ultimately you have to start making money and an income out of it. How did you go about getting your first customers for Avam, apart from yourself, obviously?
Yeah. I think that's a good question. Before I go to the last stage, I think the third part that you mentioned, which says starting your artistic journey or your entrepreneurial journey. I think one of the biggest reasons we started the entrepreneurial journey is that we knew that we didn't have anybody who will give us a chance. If I came and said, hey, I have a play, can I create it? Nobody is going to give you a chance. Nobody from in my family is in the artistic world to say, okay, poi pannu, right? Or there is no ready person out there saying, hey, we are waiting for scripts to get produced tomorrow, right? So I think you are in the artistic journey for sure. You are probably the first validation that you need to give yourself. You need to validate yourself constantly. And that's a very, very difficult journey of courage and loneliness, right? Because at some level, you'll start realizing, saying, shit, am I the only one who's clapping for the script I wrote? Right? Yes, you will be the only one clapping for a very long time until you eventually hear other people starting forming an applause. And eventually people will be like, oh, that was a standing ovation. You'll be like, no, a standing ovation is many hours of clapping for myself first. Right. So on that front, I think that journey is extremely important. And that's an important point for every artist and every creator out there, that you need to absolutely be your own nurturing space first and foremost. All right. So that's one reason why entrepreneurship becomes an extremely vital weapon to be able to give yourself an opportunity. Who else will give you an opportunity? You will give yourself an opportunity first. And if you yourself don't give yourself an opportunity, why should somebody else? Right. So that's the first question. Second is to make a living out of it, or to convince people to buy it or invest in it or be a part of it or partner with it. Yeah, you have to hustle it out there, man. I don't think any of our first pieces of art or the first projects we worked on are extremely great projects. All of them are, they are just prototypes of a future perfectness, right? And when you get somebody to invest in your prototype, you have to sell them the vision that it's phenomenal, it's fantastic. So you need to hype yourself up to a certain degree where you hope that they see the vision. Right. And even if they don't see the vision, they should at least pay for today's version of the vision. Right. So I think our first sponsors who came and used Avum as an advertising platform, or audiences who bought our first tickets, our first 10 years of audiences in the theater and the stand-up world were all people who are just trying something, saying, hey, these youngsters are doing something damn cool in our city, man. Let's go try this, right? So all those people, we never took their money for granted. We were extremely grateful for the 299 and 149 and 349 rupees they used to invest in us. And I think just that doing justice to that investment that they made kept us going. And therefore, we constantly saw ourselves as entertaining them. And once we stopped depending only on that kind of investment, I think we were able to create more artistically interesting ventures, which were, it was not just driven by what the audiences wanted. It was largely driven by what do we feel we should say or give as such. So, yeah, I think you have to hustle your way to get that first 1,000 people who will put money and say, I want to watch your art. Hmm. Right? It is, you have to be immodest. You have to be, I think, humble enough to say, please give me a chance. You can't just stand and say, no, I'll wait. Whoever comes in, I will give them a great time. No, you can't stand on a high horse. You have to be walking on that road and giving a pamphlet saying, vandu parangle, please vandu parangle, please vandu parangle, edho panirukom. You know, mentality illana, you will not get those people coming in. And hook or crook, you need to get those 1,000 people into your establishment. You will have to beg and plead and cajole and charm people into
investment. Yeah, I think at some point we have to be a go-getter, right? I mean, we have to just go and tell people to come watch our show or use our product, because no one is going to do it voluntarily, and we are not big names to start off with, so there is nothing wrong in it. And I think a lot of people have this inhibition that what will people think and all of that. So I think all of that need to be parked on the side.
Yeah, I think on the kuvi kuvi vikkaradhen solvang, yeah. You need to, like today, people on my Instagram and social media will be like, why are you constantly selling? I'm like, hey, that's my business, man. I'm not ashamed of it. You can choose not to buy, but I'm constantly going to be selling because I know the value of every ticket I sell. It nurtures my life in the arts. And a life in the arts is no joke, man. No bloody joke. And 20 years I have been in this as a professional artist. I know the value of every kuvi fine.
Yeah, I mean, may the conversion rate might not be as much, but then, you know, it's all about the numbers, right? Like if there is 10% conversion rate, you tell 100 people versus you tell 200 people, you know, you are getting the benefit of it. So yeah, completely, completely true. Yeah. Karthik, I wanna just move to the advertising. I know you touched briefly on getting your first sponsor and so on. You know, it's been a long time since Avum has started. It's been close to, I'm just going to guess, 15 years, 10 to 15 years.
Right? 20 years in the entrepreneurial world, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. So 20 years of Avum, and how has this whole sponsorship or, you know, getting products out in the market and getting people to invest in it changed? Is it still, because, you know, I'm guessing like in the mid 2000s, like you mentioned, you know, it's probably a stage show where people buy tickets and there are sponsors with banners and all in the stage. So that's probably how it worked in the 2000s. How has it changed now that we are talking in 2023?
I think our first turning point was the recession in 2008, when sponsorship money is dried out completely. We realized we had to maneuver a two-year period between 2008 to 2010 where we were absolutely bereft of sponsors, right? That negotiating that period taught us saying we should never have to depend on sponsors again, you know, because even today I see so many art forms dependent on sponsors, and sponsors become like rajas, you know, who are at some level, you are waiting for their largesse in order to be able to create your art, right? Then you will always be only creating art that the Raja sponsor. You know, you can't keep on painting pictures of the Raja, right? It kills your art form if that's all is the art that you're producing. So I think the first, 2008 was our first point where we said, no, I think we need to move out of the sponsorship model. We need to be driven by the number of tickets we sell or the number of investors who are likely to come in to a project and make it viable, right? And therefore, 2009, 2010, we saw our first investors coming in, and our investors came in and invested into, hey, guys, can you use theater and live performance and arts into corporate training? You know, that's one way of which you can make your entire art form much more financially viable over a longer period of time, right? And therefore, we created a company called Avum Corporate Training Private Limited. And also the brand that we run under it is called Sideways Training. So we do training sideways. So even today, Sideways is, a 14-year-old company right now, which does corporate training using arts methodologies, right? So I think our investors who came in were, in fact, more forward-thinking than us, saying, hey, this will be the best step for you guys to make even your artistic journeys viable in the longer term, right? So, in fact, one of our investors said, think of it, in 14 years from now, 15 years from now, your own company will become a sponsor for your artistic product, right? I was shocked when he said that. I was saying, that sounds too good to be true. And that became true. So God bless our investors who helped us see that. But I think that has been the journey. Today, we are on our 21st year of existence and survival because of the fact that we were able to create financially viable divisions and products constantly, so that if we make money on this, we'll lose money on something else. And it kind of, at no point of time, Avom has been so hugely profitable that we have suddenly got 100 people greedily coming in and biting off us. We have always made money and then spent it on something else, right? So we're always, at all points of time, you at the end of the year, we'll be Danakidini somehow, right? So it's, at the end of the day, if you have created enough art out there that is exciting, fun, makes some sense for people to buy and enjoy and consume and feel changed, I think that's a good life spent.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty cool. Can you give me a sneak peek on how this whole corporate training works? Because I've spoken to several other stand-up comedians, and they say that their sort of income is broken down into two. If they get a special, then great. If they do stage shows, then fantastic. But the third stream is usually corporate events. So I think this is completely different, right? This is corporate training. Yeah. So could you give me a sneak peek on what that is about?
Okay. So corporate training is what largely corporates are looking to change the behavior of their employees towards a certain corporate agenda or towards a certain sales incentive or a project or even if you look at something like prevention of sexual harassment within a corporate, you're trying to change mindsets, behavior, emotional reactions of people. And this is the most difficult thing to do, because technically behavioral change is the most difficult thing to do to adult human beings. You can't change somebody's behavior. And therefore, corporate training methodologies are all blunt instruments because of the fact that you're trying to teach them through PowerPoint slides and manuals and speeches and boring animated videos. These are all extremely boring ways in which your mind is not even excited enough to go through the training programs. So many HR programs within corporates are where adults put attendance and then disappear. They're never mentally, emotionally present in any of those training programs. But what if those boring training programs could become less boring, could become entertaining, could become engaging?
On that note, I just want to interrupt. I was talking to someone the other day, and I was asking them about the music tastes and things, and podcast tastes, obviously. So the answer was that when do I listen to podcasts? I listen to podcasts when I'm doing mundane trainings. So see, yeah.
Absolutely. And you need to learn something new. You need to be engaged with that learning process, right? And therefore, corporates are always trying to teach something to employees that employees don't want to learn, right? So therefore, you need to do it in a fun manner. So it's not very different from the way parents make learning fun for their children, or hope that they're making learning fun for their children. So we introduce a lot of arts-based methodologies that has combination of dance and theater and role play and filmmaking and stand-up comedy. And like, for instance, I'll give you a simple example. Last month, there was this company which came to us and said, hey, we have two sales teams that are so excited by Money Heist as a program. We created an entire treasure hunt based on Money Heist. So they all came and saying, hey, apparently there's a training program based on Money Heist, the program on Netflix. And we designed an entire sales program, which was like a treasure hunt of sorts, so that you will, at the end of that, when you solve the Money Heist puzzle, you'll realize that, oh my God, oh, this is what the sales training is telling us, right? Right. So therefore, we provide corporate training in a way that people will enjoy coming for the program, attending the program, loving the program. And if they are able to stay engaged through the program, the fact that they will take back a message from the program or a learning is greatly high. Whether they will deploy it in their lives and their behavior will change, that's up to them. But for that, you have to create something sticky in their minds. Mm. Right. So I think we are very well known for creating very, very engaging, entertaining pedagogies that corporate professionals enjoy attending. So I think we kind of differentiated ourselves in a world where the current offerings were rather not kinetic and very, very static and boring. And I think that's kind of been our sweet spot in the corporate training space. This is very different from corporate shows that a stand-up comedian will be talking to you about. Corporate shows is just...
It's purely entertainment. You are not going to get anything out of it, right?
Yeah. It's very tough entertaining.
Team building. yeah. This is actually fantastic. I mean, the thing that you spoke about, making learning interesting in the corporate. I don't think, I've been in the corporate world for close to 7-8 years now, and I don't think I have been a part of anything like this. And I don't know if anyone in the US is trying this out. So, kudos to you. I mean, that's such a novel way of teaching things, especially the most boring and mundane things.
Yeah.
Awesome. Karthik, now I want to move into specials that you have been doing. It is so difficult to own a very popular brand, which is Avum, and still continue to do the writing and still continue to do the stage shows. How are you keeping yourself motivated to still be rooted to what your passion was as an 18-year-old?
I think Avum has been extremely instrumental in carving out an artistic space for the individual that is Karthik Kumar. Right today, as an individual right now, I'm able to create a stand-up comedy special and hustle it and tour with it for 2 years until I eventually digitally release it as such. Avum has given me that safe space where I don't have to work. After 20 years today, I'm no longer the primary mover at Avum. Avum is a bunch of people who run their organization. I benefit from their organization. I also participate in the organization. As an artist, it's provided me a very, very important cover to be able to go forth and create, right? So therefore, today, my shows are produced by Avum. I'm very proud to say that, my own company today treats me like an artist and produces my show, right? So that's been a beautiful journey. And my venture into film direction, I directed a film. I'm on to my second directorial venture right now. I'm hoping that in the future, Avum is involved in the pre-production of all my creative outputs out there as well. And hoping to take Avum in that digital direction as well. Mm-hmm. So I think today as an artist, I get a lot of support from the entrepreneurial vehicle that Avum is today, 20 years hence. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, I'm able to not worry about the mechanics of how do I release this? How will I tour this? How will I sell tickets? Who will manage my shows? Who will tomorrow help me produce my film? So I think Avum is a vehicle that will help create that muscle that I don't need to flex myself.
Yeah. So sounds like, whatever you built over the last 20 years is running like such a good, well-oiled machine that you are able to do whatever you feel like, you are owning your time.
Yeah,
you are doing whatever creative you want to do. That is fantastic. Walk me through the journey of how you got your first special and what are you working on currently?
So I'm at the fag end of my current show called Unsplaining. It's my fourth stand-up comedy special. The first being #PokeMe. My second was Second Decoction in 2016, 2017. My third was Blood Chutney that went on Amazon Prime Video in 2018. And Unsplaining is my fourth comedy special. It will see a digital release in 2024. It will see a US tour in Feb, which will be the last leg of live touring. I've been doing live touring with the show for the last 20 months. So it's been extremely grueling period of travel and hustle.
I know, we have been coordinating about this episode for I don't know how long, right?
I'm so sorry about that.
No. I mean, that's the nature of it, That's the nature of it.
Yeah. But interestingly, I mean, I wrote the show in 2021, 2022. And therefore, 2023, I was able to tour with it. And while touring with it, I wrote my next film script. And therefore, you know, that's the film I'll make in 2024. And while I'm making that film, I will write my next comedy special, which will release in 2025. So it's at all points of time, I am part performer, I'm part writer, I'm part producer, because I'm trying to get it produced and create. So it's a very engaging, involving journey. It's emotionally extremely tiring, but at the end of the day, extremely rewarding, because you see all of your creations come out and become something. Whether they're criticized or celebrated, they're out there. They're fully formed pieces of art that people are engaging with, interacting with. And even a troll who says that idu siripe varla or idu enak pidikave illa, you know that it has reached so much of pain as it has reached, as opposed to somebody saying, I didn't even know that you had something, right? So even a troll, you should realize that the circuit has completed. And the circuit started when you started thinking of an idea. It's better to birth the idea and suffer its growing pains rather than never have birthed it in the first place and always think that, oh, what if this had come out?
Hmm. Yeah, you said people trolling, right? Siripe Verle and so on. And I was talking to Bharadwaj Rangan about the movies that are coming out recently. And thanks to the short attention span of the audience, you know, people want mass scenes from start to finish. And they don't love or appreciate the buildup that comes before the scene in order to reach the crescendo, right? Has something similar happened to comedy as well, where people are expecting bang, 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 bang? You have to make people laugh as hard as possible, let's say 2 hours of your show. And the moment there is a slight dip and people are just be like, oh my God, is this what we paid for?
I think it's a question of if you want to reach the widest audience, right? You have to be in the world of creating fast moving consumer goods, right? So FMCGs are probably products that are mass produced, and nobody can say, hey, can my piece of candy have a peculiarly different taste? You can't. The fact that you're making an FMCG right now is going to reach everybody. Everybody buys the same little soap and everybody buys the same piece of Cadbury's chocolate. And you can't really ask for anything special or bespoke in it, or an artist cannot differentiate themselves making Cadbury's chocolate, right? So as far as the world of that Baddy is talking about, maybe he's talking about KGF2. He's talking about Salar. He's talking about Beast. He's talking about, Jailer, where every little, there's nothing nuanced. Everything is over the top and gigantic. And so, yes, if you want to reach everybody, you have to be loud and dramatic all the time. Right. And I think loud and dramatic after a point makes one tone deaf, because if everything is loud and over the top, you don't know what silence is. Right. So, in that sense, I don't think stand-up comedy has... we are always an underground art form, right? We are always playing, however big the arena is, you're not going to be performing to more than 2,000 people, right? And mostly in comedy clubs, you see 100 people and 150 people in small houses like that. So you're constantly performing to an extremely... an audience that is willing to listen to nuance. They're willing to listen to nuance. Whether you're giving them nuance or not is your choice, right? So therefore, today I'm able to talk about, as far as ansplaining is concerned, I'm able to talk about gender politics. I'm able to talk about the societal construct of a man, right? You know, very nuanced topics using comedy. I have to make people laugh, but that does not prevent me from making people think and feel and reflect. So I think stand-up comedy is, in fact, au contraire, is getting into extremely nuanced topics, extremely difficult to digest discussions can be encouraged through comedy. right? So I think comedy is no longer going the route of saying எதுக்கு audience சிரிப்பாங்க. It's moving into a space saying எதை வச்சு சிரிக்க வைக்கலாம், எதை வச்சு சிரிச்சா அவங்களுக்கு வந்து ஒரு ஒரு ஏதோ ஒரு லைஃப் சம்திங் வில் சேஞ்ச் இன் தட் லைஃப், சம் கைண்ட் ஆஃப் சேஞ்ச் தே கேன் டேக் பேக். காமெடி பிகம்ஸ் அ கிரேட் வெஹிக்கிள் டு பி ஏபிள் டு இன்ஸ்டிகேட் சேஞ்ச். So yeah. As far as stand-up comedy is concerned, I don't think that has happened. And as far as independent, smaller budget cinema has happened, that hasn't happened. I think today you see a lot more nuanced, small films sitting on OTT platforms than ever before. Right? What they used to call, adala art padam engiyum odadu. Today you see it appearing on an OTT channel and suddenly seeing a whole bunch of people who discover a film like that, like something like A Great Indian Kitchen, which is a small Malayalam indie feature which had no huge stars, right? And it finds an OTT platform and it finds its audience, means that you have made even the most most abstruse art viable in the market. Right. Yeah. So in that front, yes, I can see. I mean, I think if you want to reach everybody, you have to make Little Soap. But if you want to make as many people as that makes your art viable, right? If you're only worried about, hey, I need to sell about 1,000 soaps right now so that I can make my next bar of soap or my next variant. I think if you concentrate on that, you're able to create art that actually makes a difference, at least to you.
Yeah, as you were answering this question, I was thinking about, the stage shows that people do is like, you know, 1 to 2 hours. And then second is the bites that come up on YouTube. That is reaching a far wider audience. And that is where all these comments come. Because, you know, stage, yeah. You know, everyone usually gives a standing ovation or, you know, depending on if they liked it or not. There's not much of heckling, at least not in India, from what I know, unlike the US. But YouTube and this whole power of anonymity is when people really bash, right? So have you noticed that some of your clips, let's say if they are like 2 to 3 minute clips, they are taken out of context and people are not getting the big picture because they actually didn't watch the entire show. And this clip is causing some harm.
I think you also have to constantly remind yourself as an artist that, hey, the person who watched it only watched it for 2 minutes, paid absolutely nothing, and is potentially not even interested in you beyond the 2-3 minutes. You know, so the person who's taking the... And they're anonymous. Right, so they're not even making themselves known per se. It's not like they're somebody known or well known putting their personality behind their opinion, right? So on that front, right now, when you look at that in context, you know that at the end of the day, you are just a YouTube clip is just a hoarding on a busy street. That's all it is. Somebody's going to look past that hoarding and say, "What is that ugly hoarding there? Right? Why is it on my street?" Right? Without realizing that you only went on that street. The street already existed. It's not your street. You happen to go on that street. Right? So it's just a hoarding. It's we really can't say that the YouTube clips is our art. No, it's not. It's a hoarding for our art. Our art is 2 hours long and happens in a live stage. That's just the hoarding. So you don't like the hoarding, it's fine. You like the hoarding. Somebody, a lot of people will come and saying, "I like that hoarding. I'm going to come and see the tour." You can't, it happens there. So it's a hoarding. So you can't really see, that's not our art. That's the most important thing. It's not the entire genes. It's just a fabric shared card. That's all it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So you can't take that. You even the artist cannot take it seriously. Saying, "Oh, I put a clip out for 2 minutes and they hated it." But 2 minutes is not your art form. It's just a reel. So somebody doom scrolled it and thought it was shit. Does not mean that your art is bad. It just means that your hoarding was put on a road that was not a road that people wanted to see their hoarding in. That's all.
Yeah. I love the choice of words. You said hoarding. I thought you would say trailer, but you know, it completely makes sense because trailer is something that is released and that is cut in a form so that it's entertaining. But this is literally the clips of your live show, which may not be entertaining. So it is completely a hoarding and not a trailer. Karthik, now let's conclude the podcast with a little more about Aunt'splaining. How many cities are you touring? When are you starting? And I know it's culminating in London. So tell me more about that.
I think when I started the show, I knew that this was an extremely nuanced subject of gender politics and gender privilege. And I'm talking about the concept of a man, you know, like how have we men defined ourselves in a way that we give ourselves no space to be able to reflect or cry or show ourselves as being vulnerable, right? We're always we have drawn a picture of ourselves which is extremely macho and strong, while in fact the reality we know is quite contrary to that, right? So it's an entire show on a very nuanced topic, and therefore I knew that I will therefore have to perform not in huge auditoriums. I need to perform in comedy clubs as much as possible. And I have to do about 100 to 300 people at a time. That's my, that's the intended ideal size of the audience as such. So in that front, I said, okay, therefore I can't do 30, 40 shows. I need to do 100 shows. And that was just one out of the hat. I pulled out a number saying 100. Right. And today I'm at 87 shows complete of this tour, and I have another 16 shows left that will culminate in London on March 9th. And I would have hit 103 to 105 shows. And that's all I can do physically, endurance wise, as a stand up comic. But just the notion that, hey, it's going to be intimate audiences and I'm going to sell 100 shows. And therefore, at the end of 100 shows, I would have ended up selling about probably 25,000 tickets, right? And that's about it. But 25,000 tickets is, if I have to sell it in gigantic auditoriums, I would have finished in 25 shows, right? But I know that the topic is one of, it's a jazz concert. It's not a pop concert. So, you know, I need to create an ambiance that is a lot more reflective and sensitive, and the atmosphere of the show has to match the nuance that the show has. So yeah, that was the idea 2 years back. And I think at the end of 2 years right now, I'm like, wow, I've completed 100 shows on tour of this, you know, 100 shows across, I think 45 cities across the world. It will be at the end of it. And across the world. So yeah, it's, I think it's, pat on my own back to say, hey, you started this 2 years back and you're ending it. And it's been an extremely meaningful journey. And if I'm able to talk to 25,000 people on this topic and make them laugh and make them engage and hopefully make them reflect on it, I would say as an artist, I feel extremely content and satisfied with the experiment as such.
Awesome. So I'll link the tour on the show notes of this podcast, and people can check it out and catch up with you during your tour here in the US.
Yes, absolutely. Looking forward to meeting you on tour in the US.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much, Karthik. Such a wonderful episode. I think I got to know, I think people will also get to know the other side of you, which is, you know, how was Avam formed? I don't think you have said this anywhere, have you? How the name came about. Hopefully people can get some inspiration out of it and focus on what they actually love. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I hope they get something out of it for themselves from this. So, I mean, yeah, at the end of the day, if it means something to somebody for their own lives, great.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much, brother. Thank you so much, brother.
Bye.